But today we're launching in a very different and unusual way. It's to launch or to publish the inaugural report of the House of Lords Select Committee on International Relations, which was entitled The UK and the United Nations Priorities for the New Secretary-General. That also is a very challenging issue, and the committee, I know, has spent a lot of time looking at it in detail. I may say that there's a lot of conversation about the House of Lords and whether it should be reformed. One of the strengths of the House of Lords, whatever its other weaknesses may be, is that it contains an enormous amount of expertise among its members. And some time ago, David Howell said, wouldn't it be a good idea to try and set up a committee on international relations to use some of this collected knowledge within the House of Lords? And in due course, the committee was set up, and this is its first report. So today we've invited along three members of the committee to talk to us about the report, and hopefully then to open it up to questions in the usual way, so that you can also participate in the event as well. So we have three very eminent speakers. On my right, we've got David Howell, who needs no introduction. He's spoken here many times before. He is the chairman of the committee, and he will start off. On my immediate left, we've got David Hannay, Lord Hannay of Chiswick, who is another member of the committee, but is also, again, a good attender at these meetings of GSF. And he, again, has enormous expertise across a very wide area, and I look forward to hearing from him. On my far left, we have Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield, who is a Labour member and, again, has enormous experience of international affairs, largely through the academic field, immediately, but also a very valuable member of the committee. So we have a good wide range of experience here today to speak to us. And I'm going to start off by asking David Howell if he'll talk to us for about 10 minutes, and then I'll ask the other ones after that. David.
Thank you, Michael, for doing us all the honour of asking us to address your very distinguished forum. As you say, we three here are members of the International Relations Committee of the House of Lords, which is quite a young committee set up last summer, in fact. And this report that we're looking at today, which was published some months ago, is really our first egg, as it were, that the committee has laid. We're now on to even bigger issues, looking at transformation of power in the Middle East. But this is our first product, so we're rather proud of it, and we're very happy to have a chance of talking about it. I have to confess, I feel slightly nervous talking about the United Nations ahead of my colleague Lord Hannay, because, of course, he was our man at the UN and probably knows more about these matters than the rest of us put together. In fact, I recall he probably doesn't, leading a parliamentary delegation to the UN some years ago. One of our calls we called on the then Sir David Hannay. And he asked us, the first question to us, I was the chairman of the delegation, was on what basis we'd been chosen to visit the United Nations. I was completely stumped by that. I couldn't think what the answer was. But luckily, another member of the delegation, Sir Nicholas Soames, piped up, "It's all right, Sir David, we were chosen because we can all do joined-up handwriting." I don't know whether that was appreciated or not. Anyway, those were the days. Now we're happily working together in this committee, and it is amazing. In a way, because when we set out on this report, this was actually pre the Brexit drama and pre the Trump drama. The more the work of the committee continues, the more it is that we find ourselves almost washed by a great flood into the whole new landscape of Britain's repositioning post-Brexit and post, and it's hardly post because we don't know how this is going to work out, but anyway, in the light of what Mr. Trump is saying in America and sending everyone into paroxysms on all sides. So inevitably, although it was quite a limited report we planned for our first go, Mr. Guterres was coming along. He hadn't actually been chosen when we started, but it looks a very good choice indeed. And we felt there was a specific agenda we could help him focus on. And that was what the limited aim of this report was, to
try and analyse that agenda, which meant we weren't really thinking about massive reform of the whole UN institution, but it's quite hard to keep away from it. The report begins by looking at the new Secretary-General arriving, what's he going to do about his own institution, quite aside from all the vast tasks spreading out in front of the United Nations. In a way, we started from a point which we didn't actually look at in the report, but is put rather well by an absolutely brilliant article in Foreign Affairs by Anne-Marie Slaughter, I think about 2 months ago, in which she points out that all the great institutions, and the UN is not accepted, are having to face totally new world conditions, in which there's been an enormous dispersal of power, a vast rise in power centres outside governments, a huge growth of civic society and in civic involvement in the shaping of the world, and that she argues in that particular article that the institutions like the UN really have to grow somewhat flatter and more open to non-governmental bodies and be less hierarchical than in the past. So that's in itself a vast change. We also, as the report makes crystal clear, reminded ourselves, as you are familiar to you all, that the UN comes out of a previous century and is, in terms of funding, still overwhelmingly dominated by the United States. If you look at page 18 of the report, you'll see that in terms of both the budget and the peacekeeping operations, far, far, far the biggest contributor is still the United States. So, again, we're inevitably caught up now with what Mr. Trump is going to do about that. What is the United States policy going to be towards the United Nations? We have no idea for the moment, but we've had a little flavour of it, which I think Lord Hannay will mention later on. The second, we found ourselves more caught up than we'd intended to start with the repositioning and refinement of British foreign policy in the light of Brexit. And if you, first of all, if you look at, I think it's page 44, 45, there are a number of ideas and proposals of how we might need to adjust Britain's position at the United Nations. Generally, we see the UN scene as one in which Britain's going to have to play an accelerated and enlarged part, of maybe not yet fully defined, in the UN forum, and try and work out our new relationship with whether it's the existing EU institution as a collective or the individual EU members or whatever, and we have to seek new allies as well. And so there's a whole new scene to be worked out there. Does this mean that we're going to be more active on the peacekeeping side? You'll remember that last September there was a UN gathering in London and an undertaking to double our commitment to UN peacekeeping. It wasn't very big before. We were 53rd in contributions out of 123 contributions to the UN. Pretty small stuff. The brutal truth of the matter is that for many years past, Britain hasn't been right at the forefront in contributing. We've got a number of ideas about how that could be changed, and we think it ought to be changed. There are, after all, 100,000 peacekeepers around the world wearing the blue helmet and 16 missions. And we really have to meet the decision, I think, that Kissinger was raising the other day. Do we still regard ourselves here on this island as part of the what he called the custodians of common security, along with America and the rest of Europe? Or are we now trying to see through the mist to a new kind of pattern of custody, which may involve, for all we know, the Chinese, who got a very large contribution now to the, and growing to the UN peacekeeping, or the Russians, who are playing their own game. None of us quite sure what it is, but the last few months it's been a very heavily involved one in the Middle East, as we know. So all those questions arise in this report. We haven't got answers to them all, but we have got some suggestions of the way things should go. A couple more themes that are worth developing, worth thinking about from the report. there were non-state actors. Well, you may say, and the old-timers may say, there's always been a problem with rebel groups, troubles within states, empowered and weaponized organizations rising up, overthrowing governments, so on. That's always been the same. That's what Hammarskjöld was involved in the Congo well over 60 years ago. But actually, it has become a much more significant factor because the non-state groups are so empowered. They are connected, they are mobile telephoned, they are linked up, they are cyberized. They can, as Daesh has shown, use the electronic connectivity to devastating effect. And this is really a phenomenon that existed before, but it's now been turbo-boosted by the electronic age. We obviously look at the whole doctrine of responsibility to protect and the really associated doctrine of protection of civilians in war, and to what extent, really it's the same question as the one I've just raised before, to what extent we in this country see ourselves as going forward with that doctrine fully and cooperating with others who are prepared to play the same game. And who is prepared to play the same game beyond the United States? Indeed, is the United States still in this game? We don't know yet. We look obviously at the movement, migrant issue. The world is on the move on a scale which has really almost never been there before in history. Well, in sheer numbers, obviously, because the numbers are far larger than anything in the last century or previous centuries. And the question is, do the established views, the UN 1951 view on the handling and the treatment of refugees, does it logic, can it sensibly be applied to this storm, a cascade, vast movement of peoples wanting to move, often mobilized, empowered by looking at their mobile telephone and saying, I don't like it here, let's go north. But on a scale where we're talking not millions, not even ones of billions, but more than that, I think those gentlemen gave us evidence from McKinsey, and we said, some of us said, well, isn't it terrible that maybe 6 million people coming to Europe? He said, not 60 million, 60 million, 60 million. Of sub-Sahara, the war-torn Middle East, Afghanistan, Central Asia, the youth of the area, and remember in the Arabians, two-thirds are under 30 and a half are up between 15 and 29, are taking up their goods, packing up their tents, whatever it is, and saying, we go. There's no jobs for us here. The climate is changing, possibly. We're bullied and pushed around. Prosperity isn't... We're putting up with tyranny, but it's not bringing even prosperity in the short term. We go. So that is a vast new scene where legislation and custom and arrangements have to catch up with the new reality and clearly haven't done so. So I think I've said enough to indicate the main points that we picked up. And what we presented to the new Secretary General is a somewhat shortened version of what I've said to you, with some, I hope, reasonably crisp ideas. His powers are obviously limited. There's a very severe limit on what managerially he can do. But inspirationally and in intellectual terms, he can do something. He can do a lot. He's a very experienced man. I saw he was named as the talking pickaxe. I don't know whether it indicates he's going to cut a lot of waste or whether he's going to do a lot of very strong and persuasive talking. But we feel that we've made our contribution and we hope we're going to find this report in his in-tray. Thank you very much.
Michael, and thank you for arranging this occasion. I think you might feel that it's a tribute to British eccentricity that we should be talking about the UN this week, a week in which President Trump is going to be inaugurated, in which the Prime Minister has just made an important speech about Brexit, and in which 50 years of British foreign policy on the Palestine issue has, deplorably in my view, been junked. So you might think that it's a bit odd to be talking about the UN, but the UN is, of course, connected to all those three as those three phenomena are connected to the UN. Our chairman has just gone over admirably a lot of the field that we covered. I'd just like to pick up a few points on it. Firstly, we did, having looked and talked to a lot of people, conclude that the UN still is the linchpin of a rules-based world. And the rules-based world was stated correctly, in my view, by the government after the May 2015 election as being fundamentally in Britain's interest. That has not changed. And I'm glad to see that the government agreed to our view that the UN is at the centre of that. But it isn't, of course, in very good shape at the moment for a number of reasons. One is that although there is not a kind of wall-to-wall Cold War as there was up until 1989, there is a regional dimension of Cold War in a number of rather important areas. Crimea and Ukraine, of course, South China Sea, and the area around Syria. And that is deeply unhealthy because those blots of black ink could spread and you could find yourself moving back towards something much more like the Cold War. That is, if, for example, the Trump administration fell out really seriously with China, or if Mr. Putin decided to make more efforts to destabilize the countries which used to be part of the Soviet Union. And so there are lots of problems out there, and the Secretary General can't just wave a magic wand. But we do feel that he could do more on bringing issues to the notice of the Security Council under the powers he has under Article 99 of the Charter at an early stage, that he ought to work tirelessly to try to chip away at these no-go areas and to find ways of, for example, bringing a Syrian peace process back into the UN. The Turks and the Russians have hijacked it for the moment. I doubt if they'll be much more successful than anyone else has been. But that is a task that the Secretary General will not be able to dodge. And the whole issue of Russia and its relationship with its neighbours is not something that can simply be put in a too difficult draw. We said quite a bit, we looked quite a bit, that it wasn't our job to, because Guterres had, of course, been chosen by the time we reported. We looked at the process under which he was chosen and we concluded that the British government deserves a lot of credit for having been the primary mover in, one of the primary movers, in a more transparent, more effective sifting process on the candidates. And the fact that we ended up with someone who is pretty widely regarded as having been the best of those candidates and did so without either regional or gender preemption, desirable though it undoubtedly is that there should be a woman Secretary General before too long, that is very good news. I wish we had gone one step further, and I think and I hope that this issue will not be ducked in the future, that we'd be much better off, in my view, if we had a Secretary General appointed for one non-renewable seven-year term. The practice of having two terms is, frankly, a giveaway to the five permanent members to twist the Secretary General's arm and tell him that if he doesn't behave a bit better, he won't get a second term. That's not healthy, and a single non-renewable term would kill that, effectively. The government doesn't agree with us on this. I think they're wrong. But it won't arise for some time anyway, because we've only just appointed this new Secretary General. On peacekeeping, as David Howell said, there is an awful lot of improvement needed. The demand is colossal, 100,000 deployed worldwide. It could get greater if President Trump is less and less willing for America itself to intervene, which might not be a bad thing in some parts of the world. Then will he be a total Hobbesian, as he sometimes looks, or will he regard the UN as an instrument that can deal with problems that don't affect the United States' direct, narrowly defined national interest? Well, we'll see. There's no point in speculating too much about that. He said virtually nothing about the UN, either on the campaign trail or since, which, considering some of the things he said, might be considered a blessing. But we will see what he does. On peacekeeping also, we did think that you need to do more to make sure that the highest quality of special representatives and force commanders is acquired. There's a bad practice at the UN whereby countries lobby the Secretary General for candidates for those jobs as they come up, some of whom are very good and some of whom are less good. And we thought that if the Secretary General had a panel of former force commanders and special representatives to sift the candidatures, that would take some of the pressure off him. We also do believe that it is absolutely vital that this Secretary General brings to an end the sexual violence abuse by peacekeepers. There has been a steady trickle of such cases over the years. It is appalling. It raises the whole question, quis custodiet ipsos custodes, and it is really damaging to the UN. A step forward was taken earlier this year when the Security Council gave the Secretary General a much wider authority to, for example, send home a contingent that was not dealing with this properly. We still believed that more effort should be put into considering whether some kind of international jurisdiction should be set up for dealing with such cases, because at the moment it's entirely in the hands of the judicial system of the troop contributors. And if anyone would like to tell me that whether when a soldier or airman or other in a peacekeeping force has actually been brought before justice, I'd be very interested to hear. The answer is zero. They take them back, of course, if they're accused, and then nothing more is heard of it. That will not do. On this issue of migration, which David Howell mentioned, it is very important not to overstate what the UN can do. It can't produce a worldwide template fixing everything in migration. That's quite beyond the organisation. But it can be the crucial convener of discussion and negotiation about how to handle migration issues. And it is a hugely important subject. So it's got a bit of a remit from last September's summit meetings on this. I think it needs to go further, be a bit more active, but we mustn't expect them to produce a magic solution. There isn't a magic solution. The solution to migration into the United States is not the same as the solution of migration into Europe. There aren't very many refugees reaching the United States. There are an awful lot of refugees, as defined in international law, reaching Europe. And how you treat these two categories has to be completely different. But I think the UN has a role to play, and it needs to do more of it. Of course, there are a lot of housekeeping issues which need to be better treated too. The UN has a huge reach now with its agencies dealing with things like health and refugees and nuclear energy and all that, and also the issues of development and climate change, which took two major steps forward the year before last, with the Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. Making those two sets of framework agreements work, making them actually happen, is going to be no easy task, though it was, of course, very good that the Climate Change Agreement has now entered into force in a record amount of time, and that ought to show climate change deniers that they don't have much support around the world. Otherwise, why on earth was it ratified so quickly? And hopefully the Chinese will be an important part of this, not because they are great multilateralists, although they have put quite a lot of effort into developing their multilateral diplomacy, but for the simple reason that they're choking to death on the emissions in their own country, and they have to do something about it. If they're going to do something about it, it's obviously in their interest that everyone does something about it, just as it is for us. So those are some of the issues that will confront the new Secretary-General. I hope that he will use what has been called in American parlance the bully pulpit for time to time to make a really big speech, drawing attention to people to what's happening around the world and enlisting more support. He needs a better communications strategy to communicate also with younger people who tend to be extremely idealistic about the United Nations until they are put off it by not being able to understand what it's doing and not being able to see anything very much happening. That has got to be remedied, I think. It needs more public support, and that will be a task for him. He needs also to carry out quite a lot of reforms in his own house and also try and prevent what is called stovepiping, which has been so bad in the UN, with one agency going in one direction, another and another. We saw a very bad case of it in the Ebola outbreak, which could have been handled better if there had been less stovepiping, if people hadn't simply thought that the World Health Organization, which wasn't very well equipped to do it, would settle all that. It didn't. It needed military backup. It needed a whole lot of other things. So there's plenty for the Secretary General to do without what I call an absolutely fundamental top-to-bottom reform, which doesn't normally work very well. I got involved in one in 2003-2004. It produced Responsibility to Protect. It produced the Peacekeeping Council. It produced the Peacebuilding Commission. But it failed on a lot of fronts. And I don't think this is the moment you want to do that. What you need is incremental reform. So this is a good moment to be looking at all this, because it will involve this country. We are a permanent member of the Security Council. We have got a big stake in a rules-based international community, and we're going to have to fight for it because it's under threat from a whole number of different directions.
Thank you very much, David. I'm going to call on Stuart Wood to talk to us.
Thank you. There's only one thing worse than speaking before David Hannay, and that's speaking after David Hannay. I will try not to repeat much of what he said, or other David said. Guterres has been in post now for a couple of weeks, and I think he's had a very good start. He announced that he wanted the UN primarily to be about the most vulnerable in the world. He's approached the job, I think, with a bit of humility and honesty. His first set piece event has been on Cyprus, which I think is exactly the sort of conflict that the UN Secretary General can make a difference to. Can't overnight solve, but can make a difference to and use his good offices to effect. I think he's been very good also at ratcheting down expectations. He keeps saying, don't believe in miracles. I'm only interested in sustainable deals, not just set piece breakthrough announcements. All of which is good, and all of which I think shows what the UN Secretary General, when his office is working well, can do, which is to be, as we say in the report, a beacon of high standards of behaviour, a forum for agreements, and bringing a bit of legitimacy and authority to crisis situations. But the context in which the new Secretary-General takes over, as both Davids have said, is in some ways quite a bleak one. Firstly, we have a period of rising tension between the P5, which makes the action of the Secretary-General and the UN much more difficult. Not just the China and Russia, I think the USA, I think we're about to enter a period where the USA is at the very least unpredictable. The UK leaving the EU changes the balance within the P5 as well. They're not just involved in sideline conflicts, they're involved in some of the most long-term and intractable conflicts. Secondly, as was said earlier, there is an issue about whether the Westphalian nation-state system on which the UN is based and its authority is based is cracking. We can exaggerate this because, as David said, there have been super state and sub-state actors and challenges for as long as the UN's existed. But we are now seeing, particularly in the Middle East, the emergence of political authority at the sub-state level in a much stronger form than even at the state level and than before. And the question of how the UN engages in particular with these sub-state actors, I think, is a tricky legal and political one, but I think can't be avoided. And then the third thing is that we're entering a period where security, I think, is the dominant issue for the UN in a very clear way. Of course, other challenges exist, but good old-fashioned security challenges are now top of the agenda again. And from Syria to Ukraine to the Baltics to South China Sea, as I said earlier, the paradox is that the UN is going to be faced, the biggest test of the UN will be precisely challenges in which the P5 are stakeholders. And that makes it the most difficult thing for the UN, I think, to address. And that's the sort of dilemma for the new Secretary-General. But three things I just want to talk about in terms of how to respond to that. The first is peace and security. It's not true that because of the intractability of some of these conflicts, the Secretary-General can do nothing. I think you need modesty of ambition, but you need smartness of focus. So focus on conflicts where you can make a difference. Mark Mallett Brown was very persuasive when he gave evidence to the committee on this about the sorts of conflicts where the UN Secretary-General can make a difference. As David Hannay said, the Secretary-General has a soapbox function to call out breaches of international law, to call out humanitarian breaches. I think the Secretary-General can be innovative in new kinds of diplomatic channels, as I said earlier, with regards to non-state actors or sub-state actors, or reviewing responsibility to protect, which I think previously has been caught up with the question of military intervention, but there's a whole clutch of issues about responsibility to protect prior to the military intervention, which can profit from discussion and revisiting. On refugees, which was discussed earlier, we shouldn't aim for the stars, but there is definitely a hole internationally on the question of resettlement and burden sharing, which I think the Secretary-General could make progress on, and on peacekeeping. There's a whole batch of issues in an area which is going to become more, not less, important. The procedure by which peacekeepers are authorised, the question of misconduct, the issue of training, the issue of leadership. All of these things, I think, are areas where the Secretary-General can profitably invest time in the next few years. Now, it could be that the Secretary-General ends up being sucked into pure defence. In other words, just securing the funding in a period when the Americans are more sceptical, or just stopping the unravelling of previous international agreements like climate change. But I think a bit of ambition in these modest areas is quite important. The second issue is reform of the UN itself. And there are lots of long-standing issues, the Byzantine complexity of the committee system, the fact that activities like humanitarian assistance and development assistance aren't very well synchronised. All these are very unsexy issues, but they're all very important. And Britain is a good force in prompting efficiency, streamlining and alignment on these activities. Personally, I think that the focus of reforming the Security Council itself is a big red herring. Not because I don't think it should be reformed, but because I think for too long Britain has, under Labour and Conservative governments, has had a sort of free rider position of being in favour of reform, knowing perfectly well that nothing is going to happen. And I think that any prioritisation of that will just get mired in stalemate very quickly. So I don't think it should be a priority. I do think, as David said, that the question of the appointment process of the Secretary-General, which there was a big breakthrough in the last few months on, a huge breakthrough, partly the United Nations Association, which I'm the chair of, so this is before I was chair, I should say, I had no hand in it, but a coalition of NGOs pushed very hard for a more transparent process with hearings. I think it's difficult to see the next appointment going back on that, which is good, but there's much more that can be done, because the legitimacy of the UN Secretary-General is partly a function of how that person comes to be selected. I agree with David Hannay that a single term is the next step forward, which we should be pressing for. Perhaps even a choice of candidates presented to the General Assembly as well, but there are other ways I think we can think about improving that process. I also think that the question of the alliance between the Secretary-General's office, the UN in general, and civil society is going to be very important. Not as a sort of fluffy hand-waving thing, but because in an era where multilateralism is under serious threat, I think that the pressure from civil society across countries is going to be a crucial bit of political capital for the Secretary-General to shore their position up. Last point, Brexit. This is obviously a crucial day for Brexit, given Theresa May. I've just watched her speech. But it's a crucial choice that I think Britain faces about how it engages with the world from now on. Personally, this is very much a personal view. There are differences of view on the committee on this. I think Brexit will affect the way that Britain behaves and is seen inside the United Nations. A very clear example is the way that caucusing within the European Union grouping, which I think Article 19 of the Treaty of European Union requires European Union states to coordinate their positions. We will no longer be part of that grouping, which will, I think, have a an effect on our influence and marginalising us to some extent. Of course, we should continue to cooperate with the European Union on lots of activities like peacekeeping and others, but it will have an effect. I actually think it will have an effect on the authority of our position in the P5 as well. I think the dynamic will be different, because it's not just that we're leaving the EU. I think we'll be seen as moving very close to a United States that itself is becoming more unpredictable and less convinced of the investment in multilateralism. And it will leave France as the sole EU representative on the P5. All these things will change the dynamic. It may also limit the kind of interventions that Britain can pursue. And someone raised in the course of the hearings the case of where if Britain wants to criticise a country like China on human rights, if it's part of the EU, it's more protected against retaliatory either rhetoric or action than if it's on its own. So there are, I think, costs that we will face as a result. And I think it's not clear what an alternative grouping can be. The Commonwealth has lots and lots of strengths. I don't think it's a viable grouping within the United Nations. It doesn't have a presence, and I don't think there's an appetite to form that. But the big question, I'll just finish on this, the big question is whether Britain uses the Brexit moment to either move away from multilateralism towards dependence on the US, bilateralism, and what Jeremy Greenstock's called ad hocery. Do we move away towards that kind of position in the world? Or whether we pivot away from the European Union towards investing heavily in different kinds of multilateral organisations. And that's a choice. So Theresa May just said, I'll quote this, she said, June 23rd was not the moment Britain took a step back from the world. It was the day we decided to build a truly global Britain. So I want to take her at her word. And I think of the Brexit debate. In the Brexit debate, you heard pro-Brexit campaigners say, don't think that leaving the European Union is a move away from multilateral engagement by Britain. Quite the opposite. And you heard Remain people argue for staying in the EU on similar grounds because of an adherence to multilateralism. So let's take both sides at their word and hold the feet to the fire of our own government and our own country to continuing with its international engagement and its multilateral commitments. And that's something the UNA UK is going to be doing in the next few years. I think this is a crucial question because the external pressures on walking away and on turning your back on multilateral engagement are going to be very, very strong for Britain as for other countries in the next few years. And that, I think, the question of British engagement in the UN is a litmus test of whether Brexit is a prelude to a wider disengagement or not. Thank you.